I'm Nish Wyseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
This week, we're talking about Vice President Mike Pence's commencement address at Hillsdale College, in which he declared, quote, "Religion in America isn't receding, it's just the opposite," unquote. Spoiler alert, that's a load of crap.
We'll also discuss the decision to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which took place on Monday, the 70th anniversary of Israel's Declaration of Independence. The embassy opening was led by Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, and giving the opening prayer and benediction at the ceremony were Robert Jeffress and John Hagee. No controversy there.
And to give us some more insight into the embassy move, Amy talks to Emma Green, who's based in Jerusalem and covers religion for The Atlantic. Our thanks, as always, to the show's monthly patrons who have signed up to support our work. If you like what we're doing at Impolite Company and think these conversations are important, you too can help us out by becoming a monthly sponsor. Click the link in your player's episode description or visit patreon.com, that's patreon.com/impolitecompanypodcast to sign up. You can give as little as $1 a month, and every little bit helps.
First up is our regular weekly segment, 3 Minutes of Nish. This is the part of the show where she gets time to rant about whatever she wants, but for no more than 3 minutes. Nish, your time starts now.
Oh, Amy, it was revealed this week that on the recommendation of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the head of the Family Research Council and arch nemesis of the pod, Tony Perkins, was appointed to the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. The commission is an independent, bipartisan, and it's an official U.S. federal government commission that was created in 1998 as a part of the International Religious Freedom Act. After his appointment was made public, Perkins said, quote, "I look forward to doing all that I can to ensure that our government is the single biggest defender of religious freedom internationally," unquote. Really? Really? You, Tony Perkins, you're going to help make sure that the U.S. is a big defender of religious freedom? Do you mean all religious freedom or just the kind that aligns with your particular religion? Because as I recall, you said on your own radio show that the Muslim faith shouldn't be extended the same protections as Christians because Islam is a, quote, a comprehensive system which is incompatible with the Constitution, unquote. That sure as shit doesn't sound like religious freedom to me, Tony Perkins. And here's the thing. This 2-year term has significant responsibilities. You get to make policy recommendations to the president, Congress, and the Secretary of State. Are you going to make policy recommendations that align with your belief that Islam is not compatible with the Constitution? And what about LGBT people, Tony Perkins? The Southern Poverty Law Center has classified the Family Research Council under your leadership as a hate group because you make false claims about the LGBT community based on discredited research and junk science. So what if the people who are being oppressed in the name of religion are being oppressed because they're gay or bi or trans? Will you stand up for their religious freedom too? I think we all know the answer to that question. And to Mitch McConnell, you really couldn't think of anyone in the United States more qualified to appoint? You chose this guy? Really? Shame on you. I think I'll just end with the statement from the Southern Poverty Law Center because they said it best. Quote, "As head of the hate group, Family Research Council, Perkins specializes in spreading false propaganda that demonizes the LGBT community and Muslims. Perkins' idea of religious freedom is having the freedom to discriminate against entire groups of people he doesn't like. His well-documented bigotry has no place in any government entity," unquote. What a freaking disgrace. That is my rant this week.
He's one of the worst. I would say we've got pod nemeses, not just singular nemesis.
That is true. We do have to have multiple nemeses.
Get in line, Tony Perkins.
What a fun time. That's right. What a fun time we live in. Okay, let's move into our first topic this week. Vice President Mike Pence's ridiculous claim that religion in America is actually growing. In a commencement address to Hillsdale College, Mike Pence said, quote, "The percentage of Americans who live out their religion on a weekly basis, praying, going to church, reading and believing in the Bible, has remained remarkably consistent over the decades, even as the population of the United States has grown by leaps and bounds. I mean, think about it. Today, relative to the population, four times as many Americans go to church on a regular basis than at the time of our nation's founding. Religion in America isn't receding, it's just the opposite. Faith is gaining new life across America every day." Unquote. Amy.
Where to start?
This is, as multiple studies and statistics have shown, verifiably false. But I mean, par for the course for the Trump administration to completely throw out facts and statistics for the sake of, I don't know, making some dumb argument.
Ugh. Well, and it's telling that the comparison he needs to use is going back to the 1770s. When we don't have time to get into all the historical and sociological reasons why there were not religious institutions set up the same way that there are today. But
you mean it's not an apt comparison?
You think you might want to compare to, say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and compared to that recent era, there has absolutely been a plummeting in religious observance and attendance and willingness to identify with religious groups in the U.S. Now, when people say, and this tends to get really confused, there was a piece, I believe, in The Atlantic this week that did what a lot of people often do, which is conflate secular and atheist. So I want to make sure that we're clear on our terms here. Just because the U.S. is becoming more secular does not mean that the numbers of people who say they absolutely believe there is no God is rising. Those have actually been pretty stable at about 4 or 5% for atheist, and I want to say maybe like 5 or 6% for agnostic for really the last 3 or 4 decades. But it is inarguable, and we have the receipts and statistics at our fingers that we can go through, that the U.S. is less religious. And if you've been listening to the pod over the last few months, you know that there is ample evidence that it is, in fact, the kind of conservative Christianity that Mike Pence represents that has been driving Americans away from religion. Not only is he wrong, but he is blinkered as to why this might be happening.
There are so many things that are a little laughable about all of this. One of the things that I read in the Washington Post, there's this piece where, you know, it's like a fact check piece. And the Mike Pence's office referred back to a Federalist article, which referred to a 2017 study published in Sociological Science by Landon Schnabel at Indiana University at Bloomington. And even Schnabel himself said, yeah, Pence missed really like the key point of my study. He says, Pence's language is imprecise because it chooses one thing to highlight while leaving out an equally important part of the story of American religious change. Although intense religion persists, moderate religion is declining quickly. like the guy who Pence even cited his study is like, that's not really what I said.
Kind of cherry picking here.
A little bit, which I mean, it's so easy to do, right? I mean, it doesn't matter what study or what the statistics show. Like, there's new studies that pop up every day, whether it's, I mean, on a whole host of things, whether it's medicine or politics or religion. There's a ton of studies that you could probably find a study somewhere to back up something that, you know, you're saying. But the overwhelming majority of studies, like not just this one, but like the overall trend of studies of religious practice in America have all reached kind of the same consensus. And that is, you know, religious practice in America is actually declining. And to take like one part of one study, it's just so disingenuous. But at the same time, I feel like it's par for the course, right? Like, of course it is. Of course, these guys are going to cherry pick something, you know, but again, why? Like, why would you make that argument that, like, you know, things are
I will
really
tell
great.
You why.
Oh yeah, please do. Please enlighten us.
I've been spending a lot of this week thinking about it, because you got to think about that to figure out how to counter it. And I wonder how helpful it is for us to jump every time they do one of these speeches or make one of these claims. It seems like you can't let it pass. And yet, there was a really smart Washington Post piece by Paul Waldman earlier this week, and we'll put that in the show notes. And he wasn't talking about religion. He was talking about the culture war writ broad and arguing that Democrats need to stop worrying about this idea that they're not showing enough respect for cultural conservatives, because it is not a war that can be won. That it exists in kind of a permanent state of propaganda on Fox News. And it is just the same talking points that are going to be delivered over and over and over. And if you have conservative relatives, you no doubt have heard these same talking points, because they are either manipulations of things that actually were said but are out of context, or they're just out and out falsehoods. But they exist to push a narrative of Democrats have no respect for you. Liberals have no respect for you. They hate you. They hate what you believe. They hate your faith. And it's that faith part that I think this feeds into. You know, we talked about Pence insisting that America is intensely religious, and we should note that he gives Trump the credit for that. One part of the speech is faith in America is rising again because President Trump and our entire administration have been advancing the very principles you learned here in the halls of Hillsdale College.
What principles? Pray tell.
I know. But then the important part for me is what he moves very quickly to, which is exactly this appeal to you are misunderstood and we are your defenders.
Ah,
and
here we go.
Have spent a lot of time here on the podcast talking about how ridiculous it is that all of these conservative evangelicals are still standing by Trump. But it's because he has given them this very facile argument that he's their defender and only he can protect them. But it has worked, and it has worked because of things like this in Trump's or Pence's speech. He says, "We live in a time when traditional values, even religious conviction, are increasingly marginalized by a secular popular culture, a time when it's become acceptable, even fashionable, to malign religious belief," which, you know, would seem to run counter to his claim that faith in America is actually rising. But it's important because, connecting with what we talked about last week with Ruth Graham, there is this whole industry of Christian media that exists to support and further promote this claim that most progressive Americans just ridicule faith. And even people, you know, just today, God help us, we had Sarah Huckabee Sanders at her press briefing talking about so-called Christians. And these so-called Christians were the ones who think that you actually should not dehumanize children of God. But apparently to believe that makes you not a Christian, but a so-called Christian. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to divide Americans, and particularly Americans of faith, into real Christians and so-called Christians, real people of faith and so-called people of faith. And so it's possible in the narrative that they tell for you to be an intensely religious person whose life is shaped by your faith and yet also part of this boogeyman that maligns the idea of religious faith and looks down on these conservative mm-hmm. Christians.
And this is, I mean, the foundation for that argument of, you know, there's the real Christians and the quote unquote Christians, right? Like the foundation for that argument and the foundation for that division has been, the groundwork has been laid for that for years and years and years. Decades.
Yes, this was my book.
Amy literally wrote the book on this, you guys. So, I mean, there have been decades of this groundwork being laid, and we've seen it even more, really. I mean, I think in like the last 10 years, especially on issues of, you know, LGBT people, that, I mean, that's like a huge dividing line that, which we saw just last year with the quote unquote Nashville statement that, you know, all of these evangelicals signed that essentially says you are not a Christian in good faith. Like you cannot be a Christian and be LGBT affirming, that there's all of these lines being drawn about who's a real Christian and who's not. And really Trump and, you know, Pence as well are really just a product of a lot of that groundwork that's been laid for so long. But I mean, they are doing their part of, you know, perpetuating it and making those divides even deeper, which we saw this week with, you know, Trump's comments about particular immigrants being quote unquote animals. And then Sarah Huckabee Sanders' defense of him saying that today. It's just
a doubling down. She said he didn't go far enough.
Didn't go far enough in using some of the language that, you know, we have seen time and time again in history that leads to mass genocide and horrible crimes against humanity. It's just,
what would Jesus do, Nish?
It's frustrating to me for obvious reasons, but like so many people, I have this really kind of like core value that facts matter. And so when Pence says like, oh, religion is on the rise, like, no, that's verifiably not true. That is like false, just based in fact, that's false. And so therefore we must say that is false. But as I'm bumping up against this, right, exactly right. And so that's the question that I ask now is like, it doesn't matter how many times people come out and say that is not fact, that is false, or that is a lie. None of it seems to matter anymore. And I go back to something that Jelani Cobb, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker, he tweeted something back in April, and he said, your civility will not save you. And which I struggle with. I understand and I get it. And there's a lot of it that like resonates with me. But like, at what point does the other side say, you're right, facts don't matter? And so then do we like go down the, to use a horrible term, slippery slope of, you know, using misinformation on the other side just to prove a point? I don't know. Like, where does that end? I think it's just, all of it's just really troubling to me. And I go, okay, well, how do you fight people, but how do you fight something that feels so, that's not even based in reality.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. It's hard.
One thing I think is it can get really depressing to get mired down in the idea that facts don't matter anymore and people are just arguing past each other and listening to completely siloed and separate sources of information. And all of these things are true and make us want to just go lie down in a dark room and not get up for a
you
while.
Mean you don't do that every Tuesday? That's what I do.
Oh, yes. But, you know, this is something I've been thinking about for a long, 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 long time because, you know, I laugh about it. But one of the things I did in my book, which was 10 years ago now that it came out, was trace how this particular argument that conservative white people of faith are maligned, are persecuted, that the culture is against them. That has been pushed for decades, for probably about four decades now. And I think that it would have had some resonance, but it would not have had quite the resonance that it has if it hadn't also been, I think, pushed by people who didn't realize what they were doing on the left and in the media. So by that, I mean that you very quickly had a lot of folks in the Democratic Party and on the left say, well, sure, if, you know, the moral majority is what it means to be religious, then we're not religious. We don't like that. And set themselves off as the ones who were opposed to the Christian right. Very quickly taking the religious right's definitions of who was religious and who wasn't. And being, I think, all too eager to say, well, you're damn right we're not like you guys. We don't want to be anything like that. And the media also accepted that definitional dichotomy when, you know, for years you would turn on, say, a Sunday show, or when cable news started, an evening political show. And if they were discussing religion, it would be somebody like Ralph Reed or Jerry Falwell or Gary Bauer, somebody like that representing the right and representing religion. And then you had somebody like Barry Lynn, who used to run Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, or somebody from the ACLU. And I respect what they do, but those are not the two poles. What it showed people at home was you've got religion, and that's on the right. That looks like, you know, the moral majority and Christian Coalition. And you've got people who don't want religion in the public square. And those are your two sides. And the people who don't want religion are on the left. The entire existence of people of faith who weren't Pat Robertson or Ralph Reed disappeared. That has gotten slightly better, a little teeny bit at a time over the last decade or more. But it is still the pattern that people default to. And it only reinforces the narrative of the right, and it only helps them.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. And I wonder how much the content of these conversations, you know, not necessarily around facts and what's fact and what's fiction, but truly like what all these things that you were talking about, how much of it would change if we, at the very root of it, at the very base of the conversation, we approached each other with the question of what are you afraid of? Because it seems like so much of this, the rhetoric that particularly comes from the religious right, is really based in fear, right? It's that victim complex, right? That there's, we're constantly being oppressed. It's you're not free to live out your religion. There's an attack on your religious freedom. There's, you know, however they couch it, there's an inherent fear amongst people of faith that we see specifically on the right. That I think is reflected in some ways on the left for sure, but it's like the foundation of so much of the faith praxis of people who are on the right as they engage in their politics. And so I wonder how much different and how much more ground could we gain with one another in trying to build some of these bridges and trying to move the needle on some of this stuff if we simply were honest about, like, what are you afraid of? Right. And like, if we could get to the root of the fear, and if we could start addressing some of the fear with truth, that could maybe change things more than just like throwing facts about, you know, Mike Pence's speech. Like that's not going to move the needle on anything. But if we start actually addressing someone's fear about why they think their religious freedom is dissipating, that may actually change some things. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah. Well, these are conversations that we've been wanting to get into. Listeners, you should know we keep waiting for like a slow week when we can get into some of these deeper conversations that we have like lined up.
We have all the evergreen episodes lined up for you.
Make it stop. We want
this crazy train. It's really what we want. Well, that's a great segue onto our next stop.
We'll move on to our next topic, yes, which we could have predicted would cause some news, but not quite in this horrific way. So, the opening of a new U.S. embassy in Jerusalem took place on Monday as part of a surreal split screen of news from the Mideast region. At the same time that some of Trump's core evangelicals were praising the, quote, sense of unity they felt about the move of the embassy, Israeli soldiers killed dozens of Palestinian protesters on the border with Gaza. These Gaza demonstrations have been going on for weeks, triggered in part by the embassy move, but the violent response by the Israeli military intensified this week. The political decision to relocate the U.S. embassy also threatens to further prolong the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Not that Jared was doing a bang-up job of bringing that seemingly intractable situation to the resolution that Trump had promised he would. Oh, but Nish, I just... Man, when it comes to Israel, you can't even have a conversation with so many people on the left and the right and all over the place these days. But this is just one of these maddening things. And I know there's so much that's maddening that's come out of this administration, but they did not even care. First, they poo-pooed the idea that anybody would make waves over this, that it would cause any demonstrations or any violence or anything. And then didn't care when it did, and it led to the deaths of dozens of people, including women and children. Yeah, it was over 50. Foreseen. Yeah. Well, more than that, over a few days, that the first day on Monday was over 50. But we're talking about upwards of 1,000 injured overall. And, I hope we can at least get into some of this, because I have very complicated feelings about Israel. But Jack Jenkins, who we had on here about a month ago, he's done a really good job over the years of reporting on Christians in Israel, Palestine, and how their priorities and takes on things are so very, 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 very different from the core evangelicals here in particular. And they were not clamoring for this. In fact, they were petrified when it was announced that this was going to take place. And you would think, maybe, that American evangelicals would give a hoot what their brothers and sisters in Christ, who are actually in the region, had to say about these things. But they do not. Which tells you everything you need to know about it.
When I was over there in 2013... 2015. Gosh, it feels like it's been 5 years, but it hasn't.
Time flies.
Hasn't been that long. Only 3 years, 4 years. Anyway, when I was there, we met with a bunch of different people in the West Bank. We met with people in Israel. We met with Arab Israelis. We met with Jewish Israelis. We met with Christian Palestinians. We met with everybody, like just across the board. And one of the things that was really interesting to me was meeting with a guy named Daniel Seideman. And he's like the guy that if you're a diplomat in the United States, so if you're a senator, if you're an ambassador, if you're a congressperson and you go to Israel and you go to Jerusalem particularly, and you want to learn about kind of the nature of Jerusalem and the conflict and land and all that stuff, Danny's the guy that you meet with. He is like the preeminent dude on the geopolitical issues around Jerusalem. And so we met with Danny, and I remember Danny saying something about the Christian community in Israel. And he said Christians, and this was a few years ago, he said Christians are starting to flee the region. They're starting to flee Israel. because it's no longer safe. It's no longer a place of flourishing for the Christian community. And he said the Christian community in Israel and in the Middle East, he called them the canary in the coal mine. And he said when they are sick, it's an indicator that we're all sick. And that was so poignant to me because I thought just like you did, like that, why are Christians in America, particularly evangelical Christians, not listening to the Christians that are actually on the ground, that live there, that understand the dynamics, that see the crisis, that see the conflict and live it every single day of their life? It just doesn't make any sense to me. But again, it harkens back to, you know, like American exceptionalism and we know best. And that kind of mentality that just like railroads people, even where they live, based on, you know, ideology that we hold that may not actually match up with, you know, the realities on the ground, which, you know, we have seen explode in some pretty significant ways as it relates to protests in Gaza. So I don't know. It's just, it's super frustrating to me. It's just so fraught. It's such a fraught issue and it's so delicate. The place is so delicate for so many different populations of people that live there. And the thing that made me really pissed, which I know we'll talk about as well, is that of all the people that this administration could tap to go give the benediction and opening prayer to the event of moving the embassy, which was a bad idea, was freaking Jeffress and Hagee. Robert Jeffress and John Hagee, like who Jeffress says, like, you can't get saved if you're a Jew. Says that Mormonism is from the pit of hell. Like he is, in Mitt Romney's words, a religious bigot. Oh, and don't give me a start on John Hagee.
Oh, I'd like you to get started on John Hagee because I feel like
we've
covered Robert Jeffress here. Like, people who have listened before know our feelings about Robert Jeffress and who he is. But John Hagee usually gets kept out of even those core evangelical circles because he's a bridge too far.
Which and is saying a lot.
Yes. And so I just want to note before we get into John Hagee that Emma Green, who will hear me talking to her later on in the episode, she was at the ceremony in Jerusalem on Monday, and she was talking to Jeffress, who was really poo-pooing the idea that evangelicals are excited about Israel and excited about moving the embassy into Jerusalem because they believe that it fulfills end times prophecies. He told her, like, people say it's evangelicals are just excited because they think it'll bring across about the apocalypse, but I don't know any respected evangelical who thinks that. Well, let me introduce you to the pastor sharing the stage with you at the very event.
Pastor John Hagee. Like,
all you have to do is Google John Hagee and end times, and you get like 520 videos.
A thesis. This guy.
I cannot.
Also, it's also worth noting, for those of you who don't know who John Hagee is, one of his most inflammatory comments, there have been several, again, just Google, it's your friend, suggested that it was after Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans. Mr. Hagee said that the storm was God's punishment for New Orleans' sinful ways. New Orleans had a level of sin that was offensive to God, and they were recipients of the judgment of God for that. So, yeah. Super, super great guy. Stand up, yeah. Dude.
It's just the judgment of people. Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that it's one thing to make this extremely controversial decision to move the embassy and to be as obnoxious as Trump has been about it. It is another to just up the obnoxious factor by bringing in these guys. Like, of everyone you have access to, these two are the ones that you want on the stage representing the U.S. to open the embassy. It's dangerous. And that really, really worries me. And not just, you know, I hope it will slow down at some point just for the sake of the country. But also, I would like us to have time to spend, you know, an hour talking about Israel and a few weeks just starting to get into faith and gender and faith and race. But just on Israel for a few minutes, as you know, having been there, and I've been a number of times now, we've got family over there. And I do want to point out that Israelis have been in the streets, not about the embassy necessarily, but there were thousands of people marching through Tel Aviv on Monday night in opposition to the actions of the Israeli military. Israelis are not of one mind at all. I mean, that should go without saying, but Israelis are not of one mind on how their government is dealing with Palestinians, and have not been for a very long time. And I want those Israelis recognized too, because they tend to get airbrushed out of the conversations. But it's not until you've been to Israel that, and to the territories, that you can understand the depth of suffering in the West Bank and in Gaza. But it's also not until you've been to Israel and you stand in the Golan Heights in, say, a vineyard, and you can see Syria from there. You know, we made fun of Sarah Palin talking about how she could see Russia from her house.
God, that was... Remember
but
those times?
In
that
Israel,
was nice.
You can see Lebanon. It's right over there. And you can see Syria. And it is a minuscule country surrounded on all but one side by people who really don't want it to exist. And of the many other conversations I want us to have is rising anti-Semitism in the UK right now. We have talked about anti-Semitic attacks on the rise in the US over the past couple of years. Like, Israel exists to be a safe harbor, and it's not that safe, actually, but a safe harbor of a sort for Jews. And I feel really strongly that it needs to be that safe harbor. Now, it doesn't mean that you excuse whatever the Israeli government does, but I don't feel like the Christian conservative evangelicals who are so rah-rah for Israel and rah-rah for Jerusalem have a truly empathetic understanding of the situation on the ground for Israelis.
No, of course.
And they certainly don't for Palestinians.
No, but, gosh, no. And I mean, it, again, what you were saying is so true. You don't really understand it unless you've been there. And so this is probably my plea to every listener. If you ever have the opportunity to go, for the love of all that's holy and the Holy Land, go.
Go to Israel.
Go to Israel. Go to the
and
West Bank.
And let us know. We'll give you some stuff to go to. There's an awesome kangaroo park that we went to. The Gongaroo.
What?
So much fun.
I missed that.
Dozens of kangaroos. And you can just stand there and pet them. They hop right
oh
by
my
you.
Gosh.
It's amazing. But anyway.
That is amazing.
One of many things in Israel.
And honestly, it's worth going to the Middle East, to Israel and the West Bank, just for the food. The food is unbelievable. But
also to realize you can drive from one side to the other in about an hour and a half.
It's
insane.
Nice. It's wonderful.
We're not talking about a large country.
No, you can hit all the major holy sites in like 3 days. It's great. But do go if you have the opportunity, because that was one of the things that truly opened my eyes. Like, I knew, I understood in my head kind of like what the discrepancies were between being an Israeli citizen and then being a citizen in the West Bank. You hear about it, you see pictures, you listen to stories, but you don't really understand it until you see it for yourself. And that was one of the moments for me of driving from the nation of Israel to the Israel nation state into the West Bank was like, oh, now I see the discrepancies between living conditions and employment opportunities and even access to water and electricity. And like the difference between the two places is so vast and so stark. And so when you, and I'm now, let me be clear as well. There are the people, there are the citizens of, you know, the Palestinian territories, and then there are the organizations that are leading those territories. And I want to make sure to distinguish, just like we said, that Israel is not all of one mind, neither are the Palestinian territories, that, you know, there are a lot of different opinions as to, you know, who should govern and how they should govern and how they should relate to Israel and the Israeli government, yada, yada. But man, seeing how the Palestinians are forced to live, I'm not condoning violence, but yet seeing it with my own eyes, I think I understand it, which understanding is a huge step. And that for me was key, is just going and seeing it for myself. And so, yeah, if you have the opportunity to go, it adds something, or it, at least it did for me and for a lot of the women that I traveled with. It added something that I think is so desperate in the conversation when it surrounds Israel and Palestine, and that's nuance and complication, and that, oh, this is so tricky. This is so delicate. This is so fraught. And it needs to be treated as such. It can't be treated with these brash moves and these, you know, horrible appointments of these people saying these prayers that should never be allowed to represent the United States. Like, it makes such a horrible statement. And we're just not treating, this administration is not treating the region with the care and nuance that it needs. And I really do fear that it's going to get worse before it gets better. I don't know how Emma feels about that, but it sure feels that way to me. There's a lot more that we can discuss about the embassy move. Like I said, it's a complicated geopolitical and religious issue, and it has plagued the region and American politics for years. And there's so much to unpack. We could unpack it in multiple episodes, but lucky for us, to break down the embassy move for you listeners, Amy, you talked to Emma Green from The Atlantic.
So thank you, Emma, for joining us. I know that it is late over there in Jerusalem, but I'm so excited that we could have you on the podcast as somebody who is actually on the ground and has been reporting about all of this week. So you were at the embassy opening, is that right?
I was back in the press section watching everything unfold.
You have been living in Jerusalem to report for The Atlantic. So you have a better sense maybe than most of kind of what the emotions have been like leading up to the opening and even surrounding the announcement that this was going to take place, because the discussions of moving the embassy aren't exactly new. The decision by the Trump administration to actually follow through with it is what has kind of taken some people by surprise.
Certainly. It's been part of the discourse here since at least early December, when President Trump made his announcement that he was planning to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and move the embassy. I would say one of the strongest takeaways for me being here physically on the ground is just how distant the conversation in the U.S. is from the conversation here in Israel. And I mean that in a couple of different ways. The first is that in general, although the embassy move definitely registered in Israeli society, I don't think the vast majority of Israelis care a whole ton. I think some Israelis, and particularly those who might identify as Zionists, think, okay, this is great. Its superpower is confirming what we already know, which is that all of our governmental operations are based here in Jerusalem. It's been functionally our capital for 40 plus years. And that is fine. It's sort of a neutral fact. And then I would say on the Palestinian side, there's been quite a bit of attention from Palestinian activists and leaders, statements that were put out, certainly spokesmen from Hamas, spokesmen from the Palestinian Authority, calling this out and calling it a diplomatic catastrophe. For normal Palestinians, I think the opinions range from angry. I talked to people who were very angry about it and felt like it was an incursion onto Palestinian land. And then others who said, we already knew this was the case, that the U.S. was basically aligned with Israel and it doesn't change anything about our lives. And so whatever, we don't care that much. And of course, this is in contrast to the story in America, which has been about the impending disaster and meltdown in the Middle East and how America's embassy is going to change everything. And also the rhetoric at the embassy opening itself, which was about Trump changing the history of Jerusalem. So there's just been quite a disconnect here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does make sense that the situation on the ground is that this is where the government for Israel is. And so in a way, and this has certainly been one of the things that we've heard from the administration, it's simply acknowledging what has been the case. The context, though, that it's this president and going about it in this way, bringing over somebody like John Hagee, for example, does that make it seem more like a provocation than just a run-of-the-mill diplomatic decision?
Certainly, there were aspects of the timing of the embassy opening and the way it was framed and presented that could be seen as provocative or perhaps insensitive to some quarters of the population here. The first is that the Trump administration chose one of the most intense days on the calendar here, which is the day after Yom Yerushalayim, which is the Israeli holiday marking the Jewish reentry into parts of Israel during the Six-Day War in 1967, and the day before Nakba Day, which is the day that Palestinians mark as the anniversary of their displacement during the war in 1948 and subsequent events after that. These are two extremely politically charged events, and the U.S. chose a day right smack in the middle of them to mark the secular observance of Israeli independence. Some Palestinians certainly saw it as a provocation to have this embassy open on the eve of one of the most painful days in their calendar of the year. And certainly, as you mentioned, the people who were chosen to give prayers and blessings, which were Pastor John Hagee, who's the head of Christians United for Israel, and Pastor Robert Jeffress from First Baptist in Dallas, were seen by some as a signal that this is really about U.S. evangelicals. It's not really that much about Israelis or about Jewish Americans. There was only one rabbi who gave a prayer. It's about Trump's base among evangelical conservatives. So I do think there was a very specific framing to it. But on the other hand, those are the people who are most supportive of Trump. You know, I saw a who's who of the evangelical world there in the tent on Monday during the embassy opening, including Billy Graham's granddaughter and Pastor Jeffress and Mike Huckabee. So that world has shown its support for Trump. They've walked with Trump, and Trump has in turn really lifted them up as people who are part of this decision. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of how Christians in Israel and in the territories are feeling these days, and particularly around a decision like this, or just the ongoing problems?
I think a few things. The first is that I've been struck by the long view that Christians in the Palestinian-Israeli world take. And this is particularly true of the Greek Orthodox Patriarchate, the Latin Patriarchate. These are people, especially among the clergy, who have been stewards of this land for a long time. So they get politically involved, they'll make comments, they'll certainly watch things, but it's very much with a long view about the integrity of the holy places that they have here in Jerusalem and in the broader Holy Land, and also about the longevity of the Christian population here. I would say specifically among Palestinian Christians, there's frustration at the Trump administration for inflaming an already inflamed circumstance. I think there's frustration about the way that Israelis treat Christians and the impact that the border wall has and the sort of seclusion of the West Bank and of Gaza has. And certainly life for Palestinian Christians is different and more troubled than it is for Arab Israelis who are living on the other side of the wall, who are actually in Israel proper. I think there's a wide range of Christian experiences in Israel, but in general, Christians aren't necessarily feeling so supported or so shining in the sun at the moment, especially when it comes to American-Israeli affairs and the Israeli government itself.
Right. So maybe it's some of Trump's conservative evangelical supporters are really in love with Israel, not so much with Israeli Christians.
I think that's true to a certain extent. I do think there are some exceptions to that, mm-hmm. though. There are a lot of American groups that operate here doing advocacy, especially on behalf of Israel. But I would say that a lot of them do make a good faith effort to at least meet and get to know some Palestinian Christians. And again, there's sort of a wide range here of what that experience is. I think there are some very right-wing Christian Zionists who don't necessarily cater to that experience. But for example, there's a big event here that's slated to come in the next couple of weeks that represents a more centrist American evangelical point of view that focuses specifically on Christians in Bethlehem and how U.S. evangelicals can reach out to their Christian brothers and sisters across the wall. So I do think there's sort of a range of experiences here in terms of how evangelicals are interacting with the Christian population.
That's really interesting. Do you know who's behind that event in a few weeks?
Yeah. So actually, funny enough, Willow Creek, the church in Chicago, is a big sort of proponent of it. It's not their event, but Lynn Hybels, the Bill Hybels' wife, has been very involved with that. And it's a number of sort of centrist evangelicals who come out of a sort of more Wheaton-ish world who do come every year and hold that event. And I think it's Crisis at the Checkpoint.
Okay. Just looking at your work in general over there, what do you feel is hardest to communicate to an American audience about the reality in Israel?
I think the first is the American centrism that dominates the narrative in America. As I was saying before, Americans tend to put themselves at the center of the conversation and think their actions are the most important here. And the domestic conversation in Israel, the domestic conversation among Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza, I think is far different than perhaps Americans perceive it to be. And the other is just trying to wrap my head around the distance between on-the-ground reporting, which happens from a cohort of very experienced reporters here, and the nonstop lines of think tankers and pundits and people who go on TV and predict things and give their analysis. This is one of the most studied and pored over regions of the world, especially in the United States. And I have often found in watching Twitter, in watching television segments, in watching op-ed articles, that there's just no connection to reality in the way that pundits and talking heads are reflecting on how, quote unquote, all Palestinians are feeling or, quote unquote, all Israelis are feeling. So trying to understand that, trying to get past that in my own reporting and have a layer of nuance has been a real challenge.
Well, we all benefit from your work over there on this issue and so many others, and are really grateful that you're able to help kind of tease out that nuance for us. So thank you so much for joining us.
Internet watch in small town McCall, small town Idaho. We still don't have internet. That is the thing that is making me cranky. I thought that it would be done, but it's not.
I picture you with like X's on the wall, like marking all the days that you've gone without internet.
Like scratch it into the fresh paint of my new house. It's kind of how I feel. But on the flip side of that, I was just talking with my husband about it recently, and I mean, we've gone without internet, like high speed internet in our house now. We're using like one of our iPads as a hotspot, which is super unreliable, and it's a miracle that it works when it does. But like the kids don't really have a lot of access to internet anymore, and so they're outside playing a ton more. They're just going and playing with friends. I'm like, this is actually really nice to not always be constantly connected or have the access that you do, especially for the kids. So there is an upside, I guess. But this is day number like 40 something. If we're going to scratch in the wall. So that is one cranky thing. The other thing that I love, if you haven't watched it yet, shame on you. All of you need to go on YouTube and watch the music video for This Is America by Childish Gambino. Not only is it an amazing song and super catchy and wonderful to bump in your car, the video is, I can't even do it justice by talking about it. You just need to go watch it. It's unbelievable. He's an incredible artist, an incredible visionary. The images that he uses are so strong and so stark, and it just speaks to so many different issues in our culture as it refers to race and entertainment. It is so good. So good. I've just been telling everybody that I know about it. Like, please go and watch this video. And then the other thing that I love this week is the release of a book called I'm Still Here by Austin Channing Brown. It is such a good book. It's got a lot of her own personal narrative just about being a Black woman in America. A Black Christian woman in America. She addresses things within the church and culture at large about whiteness and what it means to be Black. And it is such a critical work. It's so important. It should be required reading for everybody. So please go pick up your copy. We'll put a copy or a link to the book to Amazon in the show notes. But it is so good. So please go order your copy. Those are my things. Amy, what about you? What have you got?
Well, Nish, it's my birth week.
Woohoo!
In our family, you celebrate your birthday all week because one day simply is not enough. And also because some days your birthday is actually 40 degrees and rainy and just no fun. So because my parents are awesome, they sent me a basketball for my birthday. I am not only a huge basketball fan, but I am a very mediocre basketball player.
Oh, me too. And got to work on that jump shot, Amy?
Before we had children, Noam and I used to go out and shoot hoops quite a bit just for fun. We're fairly evenly matched, which is to say equally bad. But it was just a good way to just relax in the evening. And we've got an elementary school right behind us. So we've got courts right here. And so on Tuesday, Noam, for my birthday, he got me a pump to pump up the basketball. Because, you know, these are romantic things. We headed over before we picked up the kids for a couple games of horse. And I gotta say, for a little while, it looks like horse might not happen because of the length of time it took either of us to get a shot to go in. There was a lot of clanging. Once I got my motion back, man, I love playing basketball. And that may or may not be related to the fact that I smoked him in two straight games of horse. So I'm kind of happy to have basketball back in my life. Yes. Now we just got to take the kids out and brainwash them into becoming basketball fanatics as well.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's a good thing. And I want to shout out public libraries because I have a bit of a book purchasing problem. And our house is filled with stacks of books, many of which at this point I just have not had time to read. I feel like just in the same way that I've been catching up with all the movies that we haven't seen because we have small children, I'm reading all of the novels that everybody's book club was discussing. Putting a blanket on the front lawn and sitting there with a book and reading, there's really no better.
Amen. So great. Okay, well, that is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way that you can let other people know about the podcast. And if you'd like to support the show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand these conversations. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.